Running a business keeps you on your toes. Wouldn't it be great if your internet connection could keep up? Introducing Business Class Fiber from Vox. It's super fast, reliable, and highly cost-effective. You get unlimited calls to all SA destinations, and it's scalable. So no matter the size of your business, you've still got room to grow. Get connected with Business Class Fiber from Vox and see what super fast internet really means. For more information, visit vox.co.za.
Bitco is revolutionizing the way businesses connect. We're taking on your connectivity challenges and shooting our high-speed fiber internet across the country. Not just for some, but for everyone. Fiber is not a luxury, but a necessity. For business, for life, for you. And being connected is everything. So network with a Tier 1 internet provider and take your business to the next level of connectivity. Bitco.co.za. Connectivity is everything.
Thank you for downloading the Tech Central podcast. My name is Duncan McLeod. Now, I'm joined via telephone from Cape Town by Larry Schwartz. Larry is CEO of US-based Seaborne Networks, and he's in the fairest Cape this week for the annual AfricaCom conference, where there has been quite a bit of news emerging about new undersea cables. Larry, thank you for chatting to Tech Central today. First of all, before we get into the nitty-gritty of the new cable system that you're planning to build, can you maybe give us a bit of background about Seaborne Networks? What's the company's background and who are its investors?
Absolutely. So first of all, a pleasure to speak to you today. Seaborne Networks is a leading independent developer, owner, operator of subsea fiber optic cable systems. The company was founded in 2012 and is owned by its management team and by a group of U.S. investors that have positioned the company as a platform play or repeatable model for unique subsea transoceanic routes around the world. As a management team, we've brought together some of the leading experts of subsea cable design, build, and operations. For example, our operations team was responsible for building out all of Global Crossing submarine cables around the world during the telecom boom era of the late 90s. We've also been one of the key owners of one of the largest cable ship companies in the past. And then we formed Seaborne in 2012, as I said, for the purpose of creating this unique platform for the growth of global communications going forward.
Is there any particular part of the world that you focus on, or do you look for investments wherever there are opportunities anywhere on the planet?
So that's a good question. Our first build was recently completed. We built the first direct route between New York and Sao Paulo, Brazil. That's approximately 11,000 kilometers in length. It's 6-fiber-pair, 72 terabit system. And so that's a system that was recently completed. And we have announced recently that we are also working on a next build to Argentina from Brazil. And we've also announced that we will be building from Brazil to Cape Town for purposes of interconnecting with Seagrass 1. But at a general, as a general proposition, we look at the world at a holistic level, not necessarily U.S.-centric at all, and we look at what global communications trends are and where we think we can see demand for financeable, unique routes around the world.
Okay. So you announced this week that you're going to be building this new cable system across the South Atlantic Ocean, and it's going to be called SABR, if I'm not mistaken, which I presume is short for South Africa-Brazil Cable. Tell us about the thinking behind building this particular system and perhaps a bit of detail about the exact route that it's going to take.
Of course. Today, there is no cable that directly connects South Africa to the U.S. or South Africa to somewhere else to the U.S. on a more direct path. At present, the way that South Africa connects to the U.S. for global communications purposes is by traveling on subsea routes up the west coast of Africa to Europe and then going across from mostly from the UK to the northeast of the US. And that route is fine, but it is not the most efficient or shortest path, by a long stretch. And so we've always had a keen interest in creating a more direct, something of a diagonal path, if you will, from the U.S. to Cape Town. And we see the need for that at a number of levels. One, we see an increasing focus on cloud computing build, particularly in Johannesburg, for some of the larger content providers in the world. And, of course, they are U.S.-based. So we see that the path is increasingly needed by them, we believe. Secondly, we see a unique path being of interest to traders looking at the Johannesburg Stock Exchange and relating that to the U.S. Stock exchanges that are in the northeast of the U.S. And third, and maybe most importantly, we see an opportunity for a new path of global communications from the Middle East, East Africa, and India via Cape Town to the U.S. At present, a huge percentage of that capacity travels through Egypt looking to get to the U.S. And while we expect that that route remains the preferred path, the backup path or redundant path for that route through Egypt, the redundant path is to wrap around the globe across the Pacific Ocean and hit west coast of the U.S., which we think is a very inefficient and much longer redundant path. And so our proposal is to be a strong second choice path for Middle East, Eastern Africa, and India to the U.S. via Cape Town.
Understood. Now, you've partnered or reached some sort of agreement with the company building or planning to build the IOX cable, which is a cable that is going to run from South Africa up to Mauritius and through some of the Indian Ocean islands and then onward to India. Just tell us a bit about that relationship and how it's going to work.
Yeah, of course. So that's right. We've announced earlier this week that we've entered into a joint provisioning agreement with IOX. They will be building from East London, South Africa, to Mauritius, and on to India. So they're a similar company to us, an independent cable operator. Their work is ongoing. They've announced that Alcatel Submarine Networks is building their system. The survey work for that project is well underway. The joint provision agreement means that we and they are able to resell each other's capacity, and that we can package that up in a single solution and a single invoice for our respective customers. And what it really helps to do is accomplish what I just mentioned, which is it helps to show the market that there really is this unique path, in that case, from India to the U.S. East Coast via Cape Town. And we think it's an exciting sort of new path for global communications. And maybe one thing that your readers may be, or listeners may be interested in knowing, I think a lot of people assume that much of the global communications world is dependent upon satellite communications. And while satellites play a critical role, it's sort of horses for courses. And the reality is that more than 98% of all global communications is still subsea. And so these transoceanic routes really remain, and for the foreseeable future will very much remain, the key means by which global communications, data, and voice are traveling.
And that's because of latency issues and also the cost of satellite bandwidth, I presume?
Yeah, so, you know, as a general proposition, satellites are great for point-to-multipoint, things like, GPS on our phones, or satellite TVs to our homes. That's sort of a multi-point proposition, which satellite is ideal for. Satellite is also really good for low-capacity needs of very rural, hard-to-get-to areas that are not densely populated, whether those are very small island populations or very landlocked areas with small bandwidth needs. But the fact remains that just like satellite technology improves with time, submarine cable technology improves with time as well. And, of course, the quantity of data you can push through a fiber route and the relative cost of it compared to satellites and the reliability and quality of service really does not even come close. It's a massive quantity of data that we can push through, and a unit cost is simply far less expensive. So it's a higher quality solution for those sort of primary highways around the world that are looking for that global communications path.
I was actually very interested when I saw that the IOX cable would be landing in East London. I think all of the coastal cables either land on the north coast of KwaZulu-Natal, north of Durban, or on the coast north of Cape Town. So it's interesting that this will be the first cable landing in the Eastern Cape. But you're going to have a landing station around the Cape Town area. How are you going to then connect onward to the IOX cable? Will there be a terrestrial leg to the network that you're still going to build? Will you lease terrestrial capacity from someone, or are you intending to run a subsea spur around to East London from Cape Town as well?
So there's been a lot of talk among parties over the years about building some kind of sea solution around southern part of South Africa's coastline. But for the foreseeable future, I think we, and our view, at least as Seabourn, is that there is a very robust set of terrestrial routes that can be taken that allow for interconnection between the subsea cables on each of the, the east and west sides. And so for the time being, we don't see the need for that subsea path just yet ourselves. And again, I just speak as Seabourn, not on behalf of IOX. But we see the plenty of ways to get from East London to Johannesburg and from Johannesburg to Cape Town as not being problematic.
I see. So maybe, if you don't mind, Larry, perhaps give us a bit more flavor for the technical side of this project. How big is this cable going to be in terms of capacity? When is it going to be ready for service? And what should consumers expect as a result of this cable landing in South Africa? Should we expect a drop in internet prices?
So we expect the size of the cable to be, it's going to be right-sized for the demand. And we expect, for example, the Seabass 1 cable that we did, U.S. to Brazil, which is a pretty significant route, is a 6-fiber pair system, 72 terabits of initial design capacity on it, whereas the Cape Town cable Sabre will be a 2-fiber pair system. We expect that to be approximately 12 terabits per fiber pair, so 24 terabits initial maximum design capacity. At a practical level, there's an upgradability capability to that so that we can swap out gear at the landing stations at each end of that cable, and we would be able to increase that maximum capacity to at least 4 times that initial 24 terabits. But the fact is, in terms of addressing foreseeable future demand, that's already a huge amount of capacity for what the market generates today. So we think that one of the key things about this is if it was simply looking at traffic that is terminating either in South Africa, between South Africa and the U.S., by itself, it might not be enough to make the cable financeable. But because we can also pull traffic from the Middle East, East Africa, and India, in addition to the South African traffic, it allows all the parties to benefit from the demands of each other to make it a financeable project. And so that's sort of the way we see that. In terms of timing, we see this as a cable that will be ready for service in the back half of 2019. So you'll see a lot more news coming out of us about this project over the next couple of quarters in particular. There are a lot of things in the works. We're running an RFP process this Q4 right now for turnkey installers, and we will be selecting one of them. And there'll be more information coming out to the market very shortly about this.
So there's lots of different business models around building subsea cables. We've seen some operators talking about open access. You've got the traditional consortium approach, which the big telecommunications operators have traditionally followed. What's the sort of model that this Saber cable will use? Will it be an open access cable system? Are you going to invite operators to become shareholders in the build? How is it going to be financed?
So there are, you're correct, there are certainly plenty of alternative ways that these types of projects can, tend to be owned and indeed financed. We ourselves are an independent developer, owner, operator, and so we always look to have a complete sort of neutral approach to how we own and operate these types of systems. It won't be a true consortium as such, but we do expect that the pricing on the route will be at a proportional cost, and therefore we think that the economics of this will prove to be very compelling. We think it's the most affordable way to build and for parties to own capacity on the system, whether they're carriers or content providers. So that model would be that we would sell pre-sell capacity ahead of the build to the carrier and content provider community at that proportional cost, and they would own their piece parts for the life of the system. And that's sort of the expectation as to how we would structure the project.
Okay. Take us through a bit of a timeline of how this project is going to work. You mentioned that you're going to start to contract suppliers later this year. Did I hear you correctly saying that? What is the timeline? I presume you have to do a seabed survey at some point before you even begin the process of manufacturing and laying the cable system itself. Up to the back end of 2019, when the cable is ready for service, just take us through the various components of the of a project like this.
Of course. So one thing to keep in mind is that there are certain things, of course, like any large project, large infrastructure project, there are certain things that can be done on parallel paths. But as a general proposition, the turnkey installer would be picked in this Q4 2017. In Q1 2017, information materials and offering materials will be sent around to prospective parties for capacity acquisition on the route, and we expect that to play out during the first two quarters of 2018, and we expect that to be summed up in that time frame. And then the back half of 2018 is when the survey process would commence, and the raw materials would be purchased by the turnkey installer, with manufacturing commencing at the very end of that time frame, and the build taking place, you know, kicking off as soon as that's done. So we think end of 2019 it's ambitious as a schedule, but we think it's realistic. And it's the kind of route that, you know, frankly, has some degree of challenge to it, precisely because it's a route that does not exist today. Mm-hmm. So it's difficult to forecast exactly the quantity of capacity that would exist on it, which is why the importance is doing pre-build sales on it. And frankly, we're, based on our discussions, not only at AFRICOM this week, which has been a terrific event for us so far, but we've had significant discussions with parties from around the world about their need for this route for some time now. So, you know, we've been quietly working on this for over a year and a half, but we also recognize that the market would not take us seriously enough until they saw that our Seabras 1 cable, U.S. to Brazil, was completed, because frankly, that's the longest part of this. Mm-hmm. So if you were to build a new cable from U.S. to Cape Town today, and you compare that to the route direction we're taking and the cost and the distance, you'd note that, you know, frankly, about, you know, two-thirds of that is already built by us and already operational. So with that in mind, although this is still a meaningful system to build, it's a fraction of what we've already built. So we think it brings added credibility to the process, that we're an existing operator, we're a well-established company, and then we've shown this, our ability to succeed in building, you know, very large-scale infrastructure projects like this.
Okay. There's a company called Angola Cables that is also building a subsea cable between Africa, I think it's Luanda, and Brazil. You're going to be following a similar kind of route, except you're coming directly down to Cape Town. Is the market, do you think, big enough for two such submarine cables under the South Atlantic Ocean?
So that's a fair question. I think what you'd find is that when you look at new subsea builds anywhere in the world, typically you will often find at least two cables being built at the same time to maybe similar geographies. But in this case, I actually think we're catering to totally different market segments. So while each could be considered a diverse route from each other for redundancy purposes by the customer base, I think of a cable from Luanda to Brazil is a cable that enables, obviously, traffic for Angola, perhaps Nigeria, and other parts of Western Africa to have their communication paths catered to the U.S. and, of course, to Brazil and South America as well. But we would expect that the traffic coming from the Middle East, from East Africa, and from India and Mauritius to instead focus on our path, since it is a much more direct route, mm-hmm. And obviously bringing with it lower latency and with fewer landings, you also bring a fewer number of active elements in the system, which by definition should mean that it's also an improved reliability and quality of service.
Larry, before I let you go, just out of curiosity, you mentioned that this is the first time that such cables are being deployed across the South Atlantic. Are there any unique challenges with laying cable systems along this route? Are there any mountain ridges or volcanoes or anything of the sort under the ocean that you have to take into account along this route?
I'd say as a general proposition, there are always challenges with these projects. And you take into account the seabed floor, certain parts of territorial waters of countries are considered off limits, whether they are, reserved by the governments themselves, also taking into account different existing pipelines and other cables that may be running. And frankly, the objective is to have a cable sitting flat on the seabed floor. And so typically from the beach to about 1,000 meters of depth, the cable is trenched below the seabed floor. Mm-hmm. And thereafter it sits on the seabed floor, but the key really is that it's sitting there and not in the water column midway between the peaks and valleys of the seabed. And so that's exactly why you do a nearshore and deep water survey for the system, and you customize the route to minimize those types of locations and to keep the system as secure and safe on the seabed floor as possible. But I don't see this route as being any more unique than other routes we've done in the past. I think it's just that, it's a key reminder of the importance of having all the data done for you're running through the desktop study and then the survey work taking all of that into account before you customize the route.
Fascinating project. Larry Schwartz is CEO of Seaborne Networks. Larry, enjoy the rest of your time in Cape Town, and thanks so much for chatting to Tech Central today.
All right. Thanks, Duncan. It's a pleasure to talk to you.